Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymyr Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymyrbaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to The Big Three. My name is Mark Rader. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymyr Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we do indeed unpack three big questions that were raised from Sunday's sermon. On Sunday, we continued our series in the Epistle to the Romans, Paul's letter to the Romans, that great and impactful letter. And we are working our way through it backwards. So we started in chapter 16, and on Sunday we looked at the next second-to-last section in chapter 15, verses 14 to 33. And the reason for starting at the end is that the end is what Paul is really getting at. It's the thing he's been leading up to. And so in order for us to properly and fully comprehend and understand the doctrine in the first part of the book, it's really helpful to understand what Paul wants to apply that to. Because ultimately, and I'm going to mention this a number of times in today's episode, ultimately Paul is doing pastoral theology. He's not just doing systematic theology. He's not just writing up his understanding of the gospel. He is applying it to a particular pastoral situation in the church. And that means that understanding the pastoral crisis or the circumstance that Paul wants to address helps us navigate our way through the ins and outs of the doctrine in the opening part of the letter. So we looked at chapter 15, 14 to 33, which does contain seemingly just some information about Paul's desire to travel to Rome on his way to Spain. He talks a little bit about the offering that he's taken to Jerusalem and those sorts of things. And yet out of that, Paul is still teaching. The description of his own ministry is cast as an extension of and an identification with the ministry of the servant from Isaiah, who is fulfilled most fully in Jesus, but Paul sees himself as a continuation of that. And the issues of Jewish and Gentile relations are at the fore almost throughout. And so the questions that were raised over Sunday kind of pick up on some of these ideas, particularly around the Jews and the Gentiles. So here are the questions we're going to grapple with today. First of all, is there any significance to the Jews coming first and then the Gentiles? Is it simply someone has to be first? How does this impact the dollars that the Gentiles sent to the Jews? So the offering that is sent to the saints in Jerusalem is primarily from the Gentile churches, as I mentioned on Sunday. This is a kind of an eschatological sign, a sign of the end, the idea that God had promised that one of the things that would happen when he established his people in the future under the leadership of the Messiah was that the wealth of the nations would come to them. And so this idea that the Gentiles were sending this offering was kind of seen as a bit of a foreshadowing of that, which I think is a fairly important piece of that. But it also meant that for the Jews to accept a gift from the Gentiles, which would have been, I mean, I suppose it wouldn't have been entirely unusual, but was a little unusual, was an acknowledgement of God's work in their midst. So that's a good question for us to grapple a little bit, because Paul does a lot around the priority of the Jews and the inclusion of the Gentiles, and holding those two things together, particularly in chapters 9 to 11, which we'll look at in term 2 as we work our way backwards through the book. A second question, why does Paul care about not building on someone's foundation? It comes across as ego, also 2 Corinthians 10:16, where he talks about his authority to bring obedience in the Corinthians. Why not water someone else's seed, as he says in 1 Corinthians 3:6? So we'll deal with that a little bit. Paul lists or states that this is part of his his mission strategy, is the way he goes about doing things, not wanting to build on someone else's foundation. So we'll talk about that briefly. And then the third question is, if Romans 15:27, the idea that the Gentiles owe the material blessings, owe it to the Jews to share their material blessings, is that putting a price on the gospel? Something that Paul has strong views against. So those three questions will occupy our time as we unpack these and continue to think about Paul's message to the Romans. All right. So is there any significance to the Jews coming first and then the Gentiles? Is it simply something, is it simply that someone has to be first? How does this impact the dollars the Gentiles sent to the Jews? So I might leave the last part of that question, the impact of the dollars, till we talk about the offering a little bit later on, but I'll say a couple things as we go. But in terms of the significance of the Jews coming first, and the Gentiles coming second, I suppose there's a couple of elements of the significance of that. I think to some degree it is a matter of someone has to be first, but more significantly, it is a reminder that the Gentiles have been included in a much bigger story. So God is doing something new in the inclusion of the Gentiles, but it's not unexpected. From the very beginning, this has been God's plan. In the promises to Abraham, in Genesis chapter 12, he promises not only to make Abraham's descendants into a great nation and to bless them and to plant them in the land of Canaan, but he also promises that through his descendants, all nations will be blessed. We see little hints of it, actually, in the rest of the book of Genesis. Most strikingly, when Joseph is sent to Egypt against his will by his brothers, sold into slavery, but under the providence of God, rises to two-eyes in the land and rescues not only Egypt, but the surrounding nations from the great famine that the Lord foretold. So there are these places where the Gentiles were, where there's reference to the Gentiles being included. So God in Christ is doing something new, but it's not unexpected. And so I think that the significance of the Jews coming first and the Gentiles coming second does relate to that big story, first of all. But it also really comes down to the pastoral theology. Paul is addressing a situation where, and we're not exactly certain, we can very rarely be certain about the issues that Paul's addressing, but the evidence that we have in the letter suggests that there were tensions between the Jewish believers and the Gentile believers. Those tensions probably existed primarily within the cultural and ethnic distinctions between them. The Jews had been raised, you know, not to eat pork, for instance, and not to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. That was pretty normal stuff for the Gentiles, particularly in Rome. And so there's this real sense for the Jews that it would have been just offensive to sit down to have a meal with Gentiles. And so a lot of their differences sit in those spaces. And Paul is seeking to address the tensions that brings about, because it was more than just their cultural practices, because their cultural practices were grounded in Scripture. So the ideas around, you know, their food laws, for instance, were found in Scripture. And so the idea of just abandoning that was just really tricky and difficult to do. We'll actually be addressing that a little bit more fully this coming Sunday, when we look at chapter 14 and the first part of chapter 15. So the pastoral situation that Paul is addressing is seemingly that the Jews were judging the Gentiles, like just kind of saying, you guys are doing it wrong. You're not fully obedient. You're flouting the Scriptures, the same Scriptures that point to Jesus. Like, they were judging them, and the Gentiles seemingly were holding the Jews in contempt. Basically, you guys are pathetic with all of your pedantic rules that, according to the Jesus tradition, no longer matter. Jesus himself said that food doesn't make you clean or unclean. So, like, come on, what are you doing? And so this tension then of judging the one and holding the other in contempt, looking down their nose at them, is part of what Paul has to address. And so the idea of reminding the Gentiles that they have been swept up into a previous story, that the Christian movement, if I can put it this way, has not started with the Gentiles. It started with the Jews. It goes back to the promises of Abraham, and it's encapsulated in the covenant with the people of Israel through Moses, and it's reflected on in the covenant with David, and it's spoken about in the prophets of the new covenant. Like, the Gentiles have been incorporated into that big story, and they need to appreciate and understand that. While at the same time, and Paul has a bunch of work to do with the Jews, right, to kind of basically say to them, the story that you are a part of, that you have been involved in from the get-go, has always headed towards the inclusion of the Gentiles. So if you are really fully, truly on board with what God is doing in the people of Israel, then you need to be on board with the Gentiles being part of this. That's the way that God has planned this from the beginning. So I think that the priority piece is a reminder to the Gentiles of the significance of their Jewish brothers and sisters, right? Like the story that they're a part of, including their adherence to the law and their attempts to be, you know, as we would say, kosher, are really important, and they shouldn't be viewed contemptuously. And it's a reminder to the Jews as well that the Gentiles were always going to be a part of this. So you can't judge them. You can't just kind of go, oh, you've got to be like us. That's not what the Old Testament has to say. To be a blessing to the Gentiles, you know, the righteousness of God will be evident in them, but doesn't say anything, you know, about that whole idea of, you know, every aspect of the law being fulfilled or being kept in that sense. So I think we just have to be really careful then to remember that ultimately this is the pastoral theology. So Paul is reflecting on the story of God's people in order to build a case, a theological case, for the Jews and the Gentiles, not just to get along, but to recognize that their unity is the plan of God and has been from the beginning, and that they have to appreciate, shall we say, both halves of the story. So in relationship to the Gentile offering then, as I mentioned at the outset, the Jewish acceptance of that, right, their willingness to accept that offering and to receive it favorably, is to some degree an implicit agreement that God is doing something in the Gentiles, right, and that they have become incorporated into the family of God. So it's an acknowledgement of the big story of God. And it acknowledges the place of the Gentiles in God's family. So I think that that's the place that really kind of becomes significant as far as Paul is concerned. Second question is this: why does Paul care about not building on someone's foundation? Comes across as ego. Also 2 Corinthians 10:16, again, where he talks about having authority, which is a slightly different matter as far as I'm concerned. And then why not water someone else's seed? And 1 Corinthians 3:6 talks about, you know, the fact that he planted and Apollos watered the seed, but it's God that makes it grow. And so that's a good question. I did a little bit of thinking around it. Looked at a handful of places to see if I could find further evidence of where this policy came from. And I'm not certain that there is a really clear place within it. So let me give you a little background. We know from the book of Acts that there were a couple of times in particular where Paul spent a great deal of time in one location. So in Acts chapter 11, we're told that he and Barnabas spent a year teaching in Antioch. So Paul had been converted. So he'd met Jesus on the road to Damascus. He'd been given his brief. He'd returned to Tarsus, his hometown, and Barnabas brought him to Antioch. So there seems to be, I guess, almost two places, right? Tarsus for a while, Antioch for at least a year. In Acts, I think it's 18, we're told that Paul stayed for 18 months in Corinth, staying there and teaching and establishing the church there. So it's not as if Paul never stayed someplace and taught, but it does seem that he was driven by this call to plant, right? So when he talks about, you know, him planting the seed in Apollos watering it in 1 Corinthians 3, I think that there's something really important in that, in the sense that Paul seems to, I'll say believe, but that might put too much weight on it. But Paul seems to acknowledge that there are those whose task is to plant the seed, and there are those whose task it is to water the seed. And that while, you know, those things can be mixed up, right? So Paul is more than happy to stay in Corinth for a year and a half, which sounds a lot like watering the seed, right, in terms of establishing the church there. That Paul sees himself as more of the planter than the gardener, right? That he plants the seed and then moves on. Part of this might be then reflected in his understanding of the gifts of the Spirit. So one of the gifts that Paul lists is the gift of being an apostle. And scholars generally will say that there are two kinds of apostles. The one type is the type that we find in the Gospels, right? Where Jesus selects these 12 men to follow him. And when Jesus returns to heaven, the 11 apostles who were left after Judas's death elect an apostle to replace him. And they list as their qualifications that they were with Jesus from the beginning, from John's ministry all the way through, and were witnesses to the resurrection. Those kinds of apostles are therefore quite limited to those who walked with Jesus and were witnesses to his resurrection. But apostles more generally are those who are sent, right? And that seems to have this element of, I mean, I'm not sure that church planting is precisely a parallel to the apostolic ministry, but it's this idea of kind of being sent out and establishing churches. And that seems to be part of Paul's understanding. I mean, he was aware of a great deal of Jesus's teaching. He encountered, right, Jesus on the road, Jesus spoke to him. He has dreams and visions and all sorts of things. But he was not, strictly speaking, an apostle of the first type, but he was of the second. And so that seems to have been part of his understanding. I also think that, you know, for Paul and the early church, I think there was an idea for him that, you know, the important thing, because as far as Paul was concerned, the Lord was returning soon, and so it was pretty important to be telling as many people in as many places as possible, that the world might hear the good news before the return of Jesus. And I think for Paul, you know, if his task was primarily to plant the seed, then I think he saw the watering of the seed as the role of the church. But the gifts of the Spirit were given to the church to enable them to grow to maturity. And so I think for Paul, there's kind of a combination of these things. And not to say that there weren't times and places when he didn't stay for a while and didn't remain in a place for a while. But I think Paul's concern was wrapped around that. I don't know as well how, how Paul interpreted and understood his commission from Jesus. You know, the idea of going to the Gentiles, that's at one level quite specific, and at another level really, really vague. What does that mean exactly? And Paul seems to have taken it to mean traveling in Gentile territory and speaking first to the Jews, right, in the synagogues, and then to the Gentiles and establishing churches. That was the deal. And then moving on. So he seems to have understood his call and commission in that particular way. I think he saw his office or his position in the universal church as being an apostle. And I think that he saw that was what he was called to do. And he did that the majority of the time. Now, that's not to say that for us, for instance, that staying and being the gardener is not a valuable or useful thing. I think it certainly is. I think Paul makes that point, that it's God who makes it grow, but you need people to be involved in that process. And I think that, I'm not sure that he's saying, you know, to the point of the question that, you know, he's the only one who can go and take the gospel to new places. I think it's his understanding of his call. I think his understanding of his apostleship is what's evident in 2 Corinthians 10:16 when he talks about, you know, the authority that he has. That's a pretty important element of the New Testament story of faith. It's actually a critical part of the story of the church, the question of authority. Who says what is right and who says what is wrong? Who determines what is doctrine and who decides and heterodox and who decides what is orthodox, you know, what's right and what's wrong? All those questions become really, really important. And the authority that Paul had, particularly over the churches that he planted, is a pretty significant issue. You find it bouncing around in quite a few of his letters. So I hope that makes some sense of, I think, Paul's understanding of his own call and what that meant for him. And I think it's also worth noting, as I said, that he does stop and stay in places as he feels led by the Spirit in the midst of all of that. And we don't know all the details of what God had called him to. So if Romans 15:27 says that Gentiles owe sharing their material blessings with Jews, is that putting a price on the gospel, something that Paul has a strong view against? So I've mentioned a number of times over the course of this year, as we were looking at Philippians 2 and Romans, that Paul was tentative or very careful about who he allowed to support him financially. The reason being that in the ancient world, in a way that is similar but different to now, financial gifts brought certain obligations, social obligations and whatnot. There was a degree of expectation around that. And you would find this today. If someone makes a really significant donation to a local soccer club or a local charity, they have a great deal of authority then. Like if the person who has given a very massive gift comes and then says, hey, I would like to see some changes in the direction, it's hard to say no to that because, well, they've contributed so much to the enterprise. And so Paul was very aware of that. In the ancient world, it was a little bit different because of the honor and shame element of their wider culture. It was honorable to contribute to others, and it was honorable to honor those who had given to you in a really quite substantial way. And so Paul was very, very careful about people who wanted to gain honor or gain power and influence over him and over the gospel through their financial gifts. And so there are a number of people like the Philippians Phoebe, for instance, whom Paul seems to have allowed to support him. He seems to be happy to allow the Romans to support him, right? Because he feels that they kind of get what he's on about. So that's a really important premise to the question. But the question is this, again, if it says that Gentiles owe sharing their material blessings with Jews, is that putting a price on the gospel? And my short answer is no, I don't believe that it is. And the reason is once again tied up with the idea that this is a letter of practical pastoral theology. Paul is, as I mentioned in the answer to that first question, is reminding the Gentiles that they are part of this bigger story. Yes, their inclusion has been foretold from the very beginning, but they haven't been included until now, right? Like in Jesus and through faith in Jesus, they have been included in the grand story of God. Like, and that grand story is not just a nice thing or a hobby that they have decided that they're going to be a part of. No, this is the plan for the world to restore and renew all things, to bring people into right relationship with God and to invite them into the good, blessed life, like the whole thing. And so Paul wants to remind the Gentiles, who again are seemingly acting contemptuously towards the Jews, you're kind of poo-pooing their kind of all their old-fashioned religious ideas and saying, this is the story that you are a part of. You can't just say, that doesn't matter. It's really important stuff. And so I think that what Paul is trying to do in this description and discussion of the offering, right, is to remind his readers again of the priority of the Jewish story as leading to them, but it's part of their story as well. So I mentioned very briefly that in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, when Paul talks about the offering, that the Corinthians are, or at least were, keen to participate in, and they've gotten a little slack on it. Paul bases his argument not on the priority of the Jewish story or on the fact that as Gentiles they owe it to them, but just basically on the basis of generosity, the principles of generosity. And the way in which Paul addresses the concern with the Corinthian church is again an example of pastoral theology. And so the way he addresses it is different. Given the situation that he is addressing in the Church of Rome, he needs to take a different approach. To some degree, generosity, I mean, it still exists as a good principle for giving, but he's not inviting or asking the Romans to participate in that offering. Right? To some degree, it's a completely superfluous piece of information. He didn't really need to tell them that he was going to Jerusalem to take the offering there. He could have just said, I'm going to Jerusalem, or I'm going to be delayed a little bit and then I'll come to you and then go on to Spain. But he chooses to talk about the offering because it's an opportunity for him to reinforce the message that he has been kind of hammering at all the way through the letter about the unity of Jews and Gentiles, the priority of the Jews and the inclusion of the Gentiles, but unified together. And so I think the idea here, you know, he's I'm going to Jerusalem and I'm taking the offering, and he sees in that a space to say, let me tell you about that offering and why that offering is so significant. I do think that some of it for Paul is deep reflection on Isaiah, And the other passages that talk about the inclusion of the Gentiles and their response to the good news of God and the, you know, the wealth of the nations coming to Israel. And I think that this deep reflection, right, meant that Paul sees the offering as a first fruits, as a foreshadowing of the final harvest, right, of the full inclusion of the Gentiles in the church. And so I think Paul is not just kind of, you know, creating a theological premise for the point of his letter. I think there's some deep theological reflection that's taken place here, but he wants to draw their attention to that component of it, which I think is pretty critical. So I don't believe that Paul is saying that there's any obligations, financial obligations, in the sense of, you know, kind of a necessity for that, which would, I think, strike against some of his deeper premises around financial support. But there's certainly a place where he wants to encourage people to be, you know, to find their place in the story, and to be generous. And, you know, as he says in, earlier in Romans, you know, to have no debt except the debt of love, which of course is a debt that can probably never be repaid, but doesn't have to be repaid because it's the debt of love, and that overflow towards those around us. So thanks so much for those of you who asked those questions. I really enjoy grappling with these extra questions, thinking a little bit more broadly and widely about the text that I've been preaching on. As I said, this coming Sunday, we're going to be looking at chapters 14 and the first part of chapter 15, so 14:1 to 15:13, which speaks about the weak and the strong in the Roman church. And I think contains for us one of the central and clearest places where Paul addresses the issue, the pastoral concern that he's really working through. So I hope you can join me for that on Sunday, either on site or online, or of course listening to the podcast at a later date. And join me again for the big three next week as we continue to unpack what it is that we're learning, seek to apply it more deeply in our lives. But until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big 3 podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Gymea Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too. Thank you.